Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Professor Joshua A. Douglas teaches and researches election law and voting rights, civil procedure, constitutional law, and judicial decision-making at the University of Kentucky. He's author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. And with voting rights and election integrity animating Congress these days, we wanted to get his perspective. Josh Douglas, thanks for joining us here on Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
So I've always thought of our country's constitutional system as pretty unshakable, but now it seems to be quaking. A new Quinnipiac poll finds that a significant majority of Americans, by a 58-37% margin, believe, quote, the nation's democracy is in danger of collapse. Some of that represents those who think the 2020 election was stolen, but it's 56-37 among Democrats, too. So as one who follows the functions of elections and voting in a working democracy, are you concerned?
I am concerned because one of the pillars of a functioning democracy is that the losing side accepts defeat, right? We have a peaceful transfer of power, and we didn't have that this year. At least it became, violent when the final step in the vote casting and counting process took place on January 6th of last year. And so when you see violence, luckily January 20th came, the inauguration happened, and that was fine in terms of the transfer of power. But the lead up to it saw sustained attacks on the results with no evidence whatsoever besides the losing side was unhappy. And then that's continued on even after the inauguration, where over a year later, we're still talking about the attacks on our democracy, and basically we haven't done anything to fix the problems that we saw last year, 2 years ago.
Well, in recent weeks, some dots seem to have been connected by journalists and even officials such as Michigan's Attorney General, who has referred to federal prosecutors the names of Republicans who signed a document purporting to represent Michigan's legitimate electors, even though Biden won the state and they, therefore, are not legitimate electors. I'm not sure all of those people or many of them knew what they were being roped into. But this has now turned up in multiple states, and there appears to have been some coordination among them, which is the ultimate focus of the Michigan Attorney General to get these folks to talk and get to the bottom of this apparent coordination. That might sound like a plot from some political thriller, but it's looking more and more like it has actually happened. What's your take on all this?
I mean, what we know, and we're going to learn a lot more, I think and hope, but what we know is that there was a sustained attack to undo the will of the voters. Donald Trump and the individuals who was supporting him, and we know, again, things like a law professor named John Eastman wrote a 6-page memo outlining basically how Vice President Pence could undo the will of the people. And so we know that there was an attempt to, we shouldn't use the word coup lightly, but essentially that's what it was, because the process in place to select the electors in each state led to a result that the sitting president didn't like. And so he tried to use pseudo-legal means, to get states to undo their certification of their Electoral College votes, or what you just mentioned, sending in another slate of electors. And the reason they did that is because under this arcane law from 1887, the Electoral Count Act, if Congress receives two slates of electors from a certain state, that basically allows Congress to muck up the system further, the counting process further, and potentially count those fraudulent or at least separate electoral votes. And so I think what we're seeing is that there was a lot of coordination. And the big concern is maybe they're going to be more competent the next time, because, it failed in part because they were incompetent, and also because there are a lot of democracy champions of both parties, but particularly Republicans, who recognize that they lost, who wouldn't let that happen. But what happens the next time when you have, a political crony in a position of power instead of someone who's going to uphold the ideals of democracy?
Well, state-level elections are becoming kind of a central focus right now as the lasting effects of new congressional maps and election laws raise the stakes. Are voting rights, voting access, and the nonpartisan integrity of vote counting in jeopardy?
Absolutely, at least in some states. You know, unfortunately, the so-called blue places are becoming bluer when it comes to election laws and voting rights, and the red states are becoming redder in the same vein. And, you know, exercising the right to vote and doing so in a fair and free and secure election shouldn't be something that's partisan, but it really has become partisan, and that's only been worse. And so you have states, and, you know, it's most concerning, well, it's concerning everywhere, of course, but it's probably most concerning where the votes are close in so-called swing states. And so these rules could actually make a difference in the outcome. And so Georgia is a prime example of this, where the Georgia legislature passed a new law that restricts the way that people can cast their ballots, whether it's through removing drop boxes for people to deliver their ballots or cutting down the time when people can request an absentee ballot. And a lot of people compare Georgia to, say, Kentucky and or New York and say, well, Georgia's laws, if you just look side by side, are, you know, more expansive. But that's not asking the right question. The right question is, what trajectory are you on? Are you expanding and making it easier for people to cast a ballot, or are you restricting it? And, you know, Georgia and Kentucky, although Georgia's laws may give more opportunities to cast an absentee ballot, for example, the trajectory of the law is very different. And of course, it's not surprising where they're attacking certain things, like removing drop boxes in urban areas where we know minorities and Democrats tend to live in greater numbers. And so this is a sustained attack. And then you also mentioned the vote counting process. So this is where we have to talk about what people are referring to as election subversion, that is putting in place partisan individuals instead of professional election administrators to run the elections. And so Georgia's law lets the partisan legislature take over authority to run elections in Fulton County, where Atlanta is. And, you know, I'm all for someone being, you know, removed from their position if they're actually incompetent, but we shouldn't substitute these professional people with just partisan hacks.
In the meantime, redistricting and gerrymandering, manipulating boundaries to favor one party over the other, what's been happening while we've all been so focused, so distracted by this pandemic and the economy and all these other things?
Well, a ton has happened. I mean, the first thing we have to note is that this is the first redistricting cycle, which happens every 10 years, and we redraw the lines for Congress and state legislature and even city council. And this is the first cycle after two very important U.S. Supreme Court decisions. One, a case called Shelby County in 2013, gutted a provision of the Voting Rights Act, which made it harder for states to engage in practices that would have a discriminatory effect on racial minorities. And the other, a case called Rucho in 2019, which basically said the federal courts are closed to claims of unlawful partisan gerrymandering, that is, drawing the lines with partisanship or with a goal to protect incumbents in mind. And so now you have these two cases which really open the door for entrenched politicians to draw lines that will help themselves stay in office. You know, the old saying, or not so old, but important saying, is we're in a system in which the politicians choose their voters instead of the other way around. Now, you do see some, I think, good news in a few places like Michigan. Michigan voters passed a state constitutional amendment to create an independent redistricting commission that had certain rules it had to follow, as well as certain membership requirements to ensure that there was a bipartisan or nonpartisan system looking at the way the line should be drawn. And that map, I think, in various measures of fairness is really good that commission has adopted. But in lots of other states where the politicians are doing it, especially including Kentucky, the maps look really skewed, and they're really tied to ensuring incumbents can win elections again.
Well, Kentucky's Republican legislators did rush through new redistricting maps that favor their party and incumbents. Democrats did the same thing when they controlled the process in the past, so some might argue that this is just the way things are, the normal shifting of the winds of American politics. Is that a fair argument, or is what we're seeing something altogether more profound for its impact on democracy?
Well, it's not a fair argument at all. You know, as any parent would tell their kid, two wrongs don't make a right. So that's just part of just fundamentally, it's not okay to say, well, you hurt me the last time, so I'm going to do it to you now. But more substantively, what we're seeing is that the gerrymanders are much more sophisticated now than they were, 10, 20, or 30 years ago. This is just not your parents or your grandfather's gerrymander. And the reason is we have computer modeling that is really sophisticated. And also, we're in a period of increased polarization. So we can predict, based on various factors, how people are going to vote. It's really interesting if you look at even just some of these measures. Like, I remember one I read was you could pretty well predict how an area will vote in terms of neighborhoods based on how far you are from a Whole Foods, as just because of the clustering of progressives and conservatives. Therefore, the map drawers can be so much more careful and nuanced in the way in which they're drawing the gerrymandered maps that it's going to entrench people in office. That's the real big concern, right? That's the thing that we need to be worried about is when if you have a district that we know how it's going to perform, so people figure why even bother running for office, right? We know the winner just because there's so many people in this district that is going to dictate the outcome essentially, as well as what if the political winds change, right? If the people by and large start shifting toward their views toward the other party, and yet the map is so durable based on the margins in each of these districts that the control of the legislature doesn't change. And so then you have a democracy that's not actually representative, right? That doesn't represent what the people want because the map is keeping a party that's gone out of favor in office.
Where is all of this going? What is happening to American democracy?
Well, the problem here is that it's so interrelated, right? You've got gerrymandering, which feeds into also making it harder for people to vote. Then you've got campaign finance regulations where big money wins out, and you've got a Supreme Court that is refusing essentially to step in to protect democracy. I'm working on a new project right now that talks about how the Supreme Court has really been anti-democracy for the past five decades. So your question of where does this end is a really hard one, right? There are people who are sounding the alarm bells about the end of American democracy because the elites are really going to be the ones in charge. Yeah, I think arguably they already are, but now they're setting up all of these interrelated mechanisms to keep themselves in charge. And so that line of the politicians are choosing their voters, I think, is a really powerful one. So, where does this end? I can't tell you. I can't predict what's going to happen in the next several years. I'll just say that I'm very concerned that if we don't address some of these structural issues, we're going to have a democracy that the people are no longer sovereign. It's the politicians who are.
Well, this sounds like a really fascinating book. Light at the end of the tunnel. Do you have any idea when you'll be ready to trot it out?
Oh, I'm still working on the early chapters of it, so it'll be a couple years probably. But it's interesting research, and it, I think tells a different story. A lot of people think of the Supreme Court and say, Bush v. Gore maybe is a case they've heard of and that's bad, or Citizens United is a case they've heard of and that's bad. But the story I'm telling is, yes, you have those cases, but you also have some cases that probably most people haven't heard of from the 1970s that laid the foundation for this undercutting of American democracy. And so that's why, in my view, the court has been anti-democracy for so long. But I've got to keep writing it, so we're probably not going to see it for another year and a half or so.
Okay, a heads up, please.
Of course.
All right. University of Kentucky voting and election law professor Joshua Douglas, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, this has been fun. Thanks so much, Tom.
A term unfamiliar to most of us has entered the mainstream discourse about where we are as a nation and where we may be heading toward what not very long ago would have been unthinkable, a sort of political purgatory known as an anocracy. It's part democracy, part autocracy. Well, joining us to share his perspectives is John Greenman. We went to school together in Moorhead. And John went on in life to become an editor, publisher, and corporate officer for Knight Ridder, and took all of that experience into higher education. He is a retired professor at the University of Georgia's Grady College of Journalism, where he held the Carter Chair in Journalism. Welcome, John.
Welcome, Tom. Great to be with you.
It's good to talk to you after so many years.
That's true.
So what do you think, John? Are we witnessing an unraveling of democracy here?
I think that's probably too strong, but we are certainly witnessing the risk of democracy declining. We're seeing evidence that the institutions that prop up democracy, including journalism, are in decline. And the experts say all of that is quite troubling.
So what happens to journalism and by close extension, the public's awareness of important things, events, and issues when constitutional protections are overridden by an autocrat?
Well, some of it is a matter of numbers. Over our careers, the second half of the 20th century, newspapers and most of broadcasting was bringing in wheelbarrows full of advertising revenue. And the philosopher kings who owned a lot of that media wanted to invest it in journalism. And they did. And lots of people were employed, and they were doing very good work. But then that declined. In the 80s and then in the 90s especially, the internet took almost all of that revenue. And as a consequence, even owners who wanted to invest in great journalism didn't have the money to do so. The number of journalists working declined 30, 40, 50, 60%, depending on the market. And when that happens, there's a lot less accountability. There are just too few journalists chasing after too many stories. That's one piece of it, Tom. The other piece is that there were events in the second half of the 20th century that led an awful lot of Americans to see many institutions with a dim light, with lower credibility. There was the Kennedy assassination. There was Vietnam. There was Watergate. There's been everything since that's more recent to us. And as the reputation of the presidency and the Congress and the Supreme Court declined, so did the reputation of the news media. And with that decline, we're less trusted. And so we can't do our work because we don't have the numbers, and we can't do our work because people don't trust us in a way that they used to.
So here we are. Misinformation, disinformation, gaslighting, they've all become rampant in our political discourse. They've turned us against each other. They've choked off the legislative process. They've eroded confidence in elections and left us as voters struggling to make rational decisions. The country's still digesting what happened on January 6th, which was carried out in service to a big lie, a gross distortion of fact that has essentially become doctrine for one of our two major political parties. But our political media seems to just keep on doing what they've been doing for decades. They're remaining so intent on covering the play-by-play, the political drama, not taking sides, that they have refused to scream out the truth. And as a result, they're being drowned out by the lies. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I think it's a fair assessment. I think it's incomplete. It's fair in what you said. It's incomplete in that the audience doesn't have a lot of trust in so many journalists. Mm-hmm. If you're on the right, you tend to trust journalists who are also on the right. If you're on the left, the same is true. News-oriented journalists are in the steepest decline, especially in broadcasting. Opinion-oriented journalists really dominate. On the print side, if you ask readers, You know, is this straight reporting? Is this analysis? Is this a memo? Is this an opinion? For the most part, they can't say. They don't know. So you tend to align with the journalists who represent your worldview. And that's extremely dangerous because all it does is reinforce what you already think. You're not open to a different point of view, a different set of facts. I think facts have mattered more than they ever have, but I think trust in facts is lower than it's ever been. So I think what you say is fair. I think you have to add to that the problem of lack of trust.
Well, credibility has always been our stock in trade. What is that? How would you define credibility?
Credibility is measured first by the perception of accuracy. If you think a story is accurate, you are likely to conclude that it's credible. And if you think it's accurate, you're likely to trust it. And if you trust it again and again and again, you're likely to use that media. And when you use a single media, it becomes kind of a brand for you. And you say, well, I'm a CNN person. I'm a New York Times person. I'm a, you know, whatever the outlet might be. And that sort of swirls around in a virtuous cycle, and credibility moves up, but can also go in the other direction. If you say, well, that's not accurate. I don't trust that. I'm going to stop using that. Then you've got this vicious circle where credibility goes down and down and down. So credibility is linked to accuracy. It's linked to trust. It's linked to frequent use. It's linked to brand. It can move up or it can move down. And it has been moving down now pretty dramatically for about 20 years. And it's more partisan. People on the right have lower credibility generally than people on the left. But it's down everywhere by everyone.
Well, I know that this is a subject that's important to journalists as targets, with many, so far mainly in other parts of the world, becoming victims of the use of force, arbitrary arrests, criminal prosecution. Besides dissuading other journalists from critically reporting on relevant issues, do attacks like these weaken public debate and a society's ability to respond effectively to things like a pandemic, for example?
Certainly they do, and you can see evidence of that across the world. We're fortunate in a way. We have protections for journalists that are still quite strong. While there are institutions and people who go after journalists, they haven't been as successful as in other places in the world. Journalists don't get killed in this country for their work. But they do elsewhere, and they do in large numbers elsewhere. So, you know, if you have the problem of too few journalists and too low credibility, and then the government starts putting them in jail or knocking them off, you know, you're really in trouble. I think American journalists have a clearer, cleaner sense of the risk of being a journalist in this country than they ever have. But they also know that they're luckier and in a better situation than journalists elsewhere in the world.
Well, back to the issue of credibility. In a world where there seems to be no consequences for lying routinely and in public, it seems to have eroded the value of fact-based journalism. Consequences, what should those look like?
Well, I think it's true that it has eroded fact-based journalism and that it has propelled opinion-based journalism. Some of this is simply market forces. All kind of media, especially broadcast media and cable media, have discovered they can make a lot more money with strong, loud, opinionated voices than they can with fact-based journalism. And to the extent that market forces rule, and they do, especially in this country, this is what we get. I've always told students and others that what you need to do is sample a lot of sources, and you need to look for converging lines of evidence. If you can get the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Economist to say on a factual basis they think this is what's going on, I think you ought to trust that a lot more than if you just picked one of them. So converging lines of evidence is really important.
Well, I know that you've done presentations on the topic, how to survive as a writer in the 21st century. And I think I just heard a lot of people move up to the edge of their seats. We have a lot of writers around here.
Yeah.
So what are the challenges today of chronicling what's happening in our society?
Well, I'd say start with a good trust fund. I'd say, secondly, lower your standard of living. I'd say, third, marry a spouse who is doing quite well, and then your chances of surviving are good. I don't mean to be glib about it. It is hard to earn a living as a journalist today, trying to work in the same kinds of institutions that were pretty profitable 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. But what we're seeing is a remarkable number of journalists who have emerged as entrepreneurs. And, you know, they're doing programs like yours. They're doing newsletters. They're creating independent news websites. Some of them are doing pretty well. Others are struggling. But they're not simply saying, oh, woe is me. I can't go to work. Nobody wants to employ me. They're saying, well, I need to be more of an entrepreneur. I can't depend on a check coming from an institution every week. I've got to go out and make my own way. And there are enough of them doing that to give me a sense that, yeah, that is a way forward. It's not the only way forward, but that's a way forward.
Well, as a professor of journalism, you were teaching people who were not only aspiring to become journalists, I'm sure, but others who were just trying to learn how it works, learn journalism. And I'm just wondering, how can we equip people globally with the media and information literacy skills that they need to navigate this new information landscape so that they can avoid being duped or manipulated?
Yeah, news literacy is an important topic. Universities generally have not done much with news literacy. K through 12 is doing more. But the University of Georgia just got accredited a certificate program in news literacy that's going to be taught at state universities across Georgia. And as you say, it provides everyday people with the skills they need to interpret what is, you know, good journalism, what's bad journalism, what's truth, what's fiction. And that is a healthy movement and one that we ought to invest more in, just like civics education. And I guess news literacy could be a part of civics education. Civics education had largely gone away from high schools. It seems to be coming back a little, and people are taking classes in government now a little more frequently than they did 5, 10, 15 years ago. And that's a good thing.
Well, it seems that if the mission of a liberal arts institution is to turn out engaged citizens who are skilled in critical thinking, that media literacy would be a requirement.
I would agree with you. And I am seeing with a grandson who's getting ready to go to college next year and another one who's 2 years away, they're strongly attracted by liberal arts education because they see that broad investment in knowledge to be what will equip them for a changing world. You know, if you're smart, if you can solve problems, if you have an optimistic view about the future, your chances are so much better than someone who's sort of digging in a tunnel and not seeing the broader part of the world.
John Greenman, professor with an endowed chair emeritus at the University of Georgia's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication. Thanks for joining us, John.
Tom, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up after the break.
We spent a bunch of years traveling around the country, and we'll do it in Kentucky soon. And we could just land in a place and we say, well, who's trusted here?
New York Times columnist David Brooks.
And so we call those people weavers. And, you know, like I say, I think they're everywhere.
There in Nelsonville, Ohio.
I think we definitely are making a difference.
Dottie Frommel, founder of a weekly community dinner.
We discovered that we really can get along with one another.
Stick with us for a nice warm helping of positivity. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members and helping local residents through Co-op Connections, a benefit partnership between local health services and the cooperative that connects members with dental, vision, and other benefits. More at connections.coop.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Our American society seems pretty fragile right now, an ultra-tense political climate mixing with an accumulation of personal and economic traumas brought on by the pandemic have spurred animosity with conservatives and progressives, Americans all, seeing each other as existential threats. It can sometimes seem overwhelming. Maybe finding our way back to that ability to agree, to disagree agreeably, to just get along and help each other isn't a matter of getting back to the way things used to be or chasing the future. Maybe it's not about moving backward or forward. Maybe it's about moving down, all the way down, to where human need meets human generosity and compassion. That brings David Brooks to Eastern Kentucky, to Pikeville and Paintsville on February 8th, as guest of Kentucky Humanities with the support of the Mellon Foundation Initiative, Democracy, and the Informed Citizen. You may know of David Brooks as a columnist for the New York Times. If you watch PBS NewsHour, you've seen him there as a commentator. Same with NBC's Meet the Press, and you might have heard him on All Things Considered here on WEKU. He is author of The Second Mountain, a book about what can happen when we put commitment and relationships at the center of our lives. David Brooks, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Pleasure to be with you.
David, we'll be joined in a few minutes by Dottie Frommel, a community activist in Ohio, but let's begin with where we seem to be right now as a society and a country, and that is deeply divided, with forces at work to sustain that division. We're contending with the isolating effects of a pandemic that's layered on top of the ways social media has sorted us into echo chambers and this very divisive red versus blue political climate. And you're advocating for a solution that functions at the grassroots level. And you'll soon suggest this concept, something called Weave the Social Fabric Project, to audiences in our listening area in Eastern Kentucky. So tell us about it. What is Weave?
Well, I realized about 4 years ago that a lot of the problems I was covering as a journalist all went back to the decay of the social fabric, or as I would say, the decline of social trust. A generation ago, if you asked people, do you trust the institutions of your society, you get 70% say, yeah, the hospitals, the government, that they do the right thing most of the time. Now it's about 19%. A generation ago, if you asked people, do you trust your neighbors or the people around you trustworthy, about 60% said, yeah, people around me are trustworthy. Now it's down to 30%. And among young people, millennials and Gen Z, it's only 19%. So people are just very distrustful of everything these days. And when you've got a lot of distrust, then people can't work together. Trust is a faith the other person will do the right thing for you. And if you feel people are out to get you, as 73% of young people do, then you're going to close in. You're going to get nasty. You're going to put up walls and defensive. You're going to go on a crouch. And so just thought, like, who is solving this trust problem? And we found those people are everywhere. There are people who build connections, build communities. We spent a bunch of years traveling around the country, and we'll do it in Kentucky soon. And we could just land in a place and we say, well, who's trusted here? And people give you names, and often it's the same names. People who are just out in the community talking to people there every week, serving their towns, the towns they love. And just finally, you can never tell who the trusted person is going to be. In Columbia Heights, a district in Washington, D.C., there's a guy who works in a parking garage who takes money in the parking garage. He happens to love following city zoning regulations. So if you got a problem with the city, you go to the guy in the parking garage, and he's like at the center of those communities. And so we call those people weavers. And, you know, like I say, I think they're everywhere.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think we all know somebody or a few people like that in our communities who are not, they're not government officials, but they just happen to have this interest. And yet they kind of do it in solitude, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes very hard for them. Sometimes they run organizations, they run a soup kitchen, or they run a homeless shelter. But a lot of times they're informal. I have a friend who says she practices aggressive friendship. She's the one who invites people over to her house for dinner. She creates linkages in her neighborhood. She sets her table out on the street and people can dine together. And so, as I say, they're absolutely everywhere. The problem is a lot of them are cut off from each other. When you're really trying to care for your town, it can be completely exhausting work. And so what we do is partly we just give them money so they can do their work better. Partly we link them to each other. We have a website called weareweavers.org, where it's a community hub where people can come together and share stories and just support each other. And then we try to inspire people to do this kind of work. You know, we're not going to all be Mother Teresa, but we could all do one thing for the community that would just make thicker fabric. And so people grow up in bonds they can trust. And I think, you know, the national change is going to come from the bottom up.
Well, David, I understand that your plans for February 8th include a listening session with people in the town of Paintsville nearby. And I'm just wondering, what do you hope to take away from that?
I just want to listen. I just want to hear stories. It was so fun to go into a town and find the people who are building trust and just listen to them. I was in Wilkes, North Carolina, a couple times now. And it's a small town that has lost a lot of employers over the years, like Lowe's Hardware. But, you know, you found a young woman named LB who's LGBTQ, and she was going to get the heck out of there because she felt unwelcome. You know, it's a conservative Appalachian place. And so she went to L.A., but her town was her place. Her town is what she loved. So she came back. She found just a community organization for kids. And so other kids who are coming out or other kids who are having problems, they go to LB. And, you know, it's just so fun to meet people like that. As the country's gotten depressed over all the rhetorical violence you mentioned, I've been around weavers, and I'm like, there's a lot of good in this country, which, frankly, we in the media don't often report on. And it's just exhilarating to be around such people.
Well, let's bring one such person right into this conversation. And I'm talking about Dottie Frommel in Nelsonville, Ohio. It's a town of about 5,300, about 20 minutes from Athens, Ohio. The town once thrived on the mining of coal, clay, and salt. Those industries are now gone, which rings a familiar bell in this area. Now, employment's concentrated in healthcare, retail, education, some manufacturing. I think the average income for Nelsonville is about $15,000. Dottie, welcome to Eastern Standard. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I moved to Nelsonville about 6 years ago, and this town is amazing. We're a small city. I started working with children and in this after school program, and because I work with the children, I got to know a lot of the parents, and I discovered that a lot of the children that were coming to this after school program were not eating dinner at a table, and for whatever reason, I'm not sure, but they didn't have that experience that so many of us grew up with, having dinner with your family every evening. And so We decided, a friend of mine, just to make a big spaghetti dinner and invite a handful of children one night. And we had 12 kids come over and we set the table, and it was wonderful. It was really beautiful. And the following week we had 20 kids, and after that we had maybe 30. And then they started inviting their parents and their grandparents, and we started having adults join these meals. And it turned into a weekly community dinner that wasn't really about the food. It was more about people coming together in a safe space and enjoying a meal together and connecting as a community. Something that had been missing for quite a long time here, I think, with a certain population that couldn't afford to take their family out to dinner at a restaurant. There's not really a place to gather here in Nelsonville if you don't have money to spend. So this was a new thing that was happening. And before long, we were having meals, regular meals of more than 100 people. And a couple times we had giant picnics out on the street. One time we closed the street off and we had a block party. We had 350 people show up.
Would you say that people are really kind of hungering for this kind of thing?
Yeah, Yeah, definitely hungering for it. And it's not the food they're hungry for. I mean, the food is appreciated, but it's the companionship and the conversation and talking to one another in real life, not on Facebook, and discovering that we have so much more in common than we have apart. Coming from the East Coast, I grew up in Philadelphia, I lived in New York City, lived abroad a bunch, and it was difficult for me to connect to people who grew up here at Nelsonville and rarely ever even leave the county. But when we can sit down at the table and look at one another in the eye while we're sharing, you know, a spaghetti dinner and there's kids running around, we discover that we really do have the same values. We value, you know, our health. We value our children. We value good education for our children and healthcare for everyone. And we discovered that we really can get along with one another. And I think one of the cool things about our dinner is that it's not the wealthy serving the poor or the haves serving the have-nots. It's everyone serving one another. It's neighbors serving neighbors. And it's not a soup kitchen, which has its place and its value, but it's more of a meal where we all come together. And different people will offer to cook and bring things. And it's just wonderful. It just built this entire community. And now we have a free table every single day where people bring their extra coats. Like if you have an extra coat in your closet, you can bring it and hang it on our rack. And someone that doesn't have a coat can come and get it. People drop off extra canned goods, or if they've cooked too much soup, they might drop it off. And there's always a table where someone in need can take something, but you can also leave something.
David Brooks mentioned that Weave makes resources available. And I'm just wondering, what sorts of resources have been provided to help you make a success of your efforts?
Well, support in encouragement. I've joined the Weaver Society online, and so I get to talk to different weavers all over the country and hear the things that they're doing and the projects. And some of them are similar and some of them are different. And sometimes they just inspire a new idea, like having a free coffee hour every day where we turn on the coffee pot and people just come and sit down and chat and they talk about what's going on in their lives and just share them. One of the things at our dinner that we do every week is talk about, before we eat dinner, something positive that happened in our week during the previous week. And people will share the most intimate things that you would share only with your family, like a woman who there's a lot of people in Nelsonville who have bad teeth, and she didn't have any teeth for a long time, and she was embarrassed about it, but she got to the dentist and had some dentures made, and she just shared that, and she was so proud, and everyone cheered her on. And another time, a person got his car fixed. It had been broken for months, but he finally got it fixed, and we were all cheering them on for that and encouraging people who go for job interviews and things like that. So the support we get is being able to share those stories with other people across the country and then bring those stories back to our table and share them with people.
And have you noticed that you're making a difference?
I think we definitely are making a difference. I think people are more open to their neighbors. They look out for their neighbors. They really value that opportunity to serve one another. I found that neighbors that maybe have lived a few doors away from each other for years, who thought maybe they didn't have much in common, discover that they both, you know, like eating dinner together outside on the sidewalk once a week and get to know each other in a way that they weren't able to do that before. And we've also been able to organize a little bit. There was a move by the county a year or so ago to take away our polling place here in town where most people could walk to it. We had two polling places and they were going to put it on the outskirts of town, which would require a car or a walk up a very dangerous hill along where there's a lot of cars. And that would just put voting out of reach for so many elderly people who don't have a car or access to it. There's no bus that goes that way. And we rallied around it and people realized it wasn't necessarily a political issue as much as it was a community issue. We needed this polling place to stay in town so it would be accessible to everybody. And we were able to change the Board of Elections mind about it. And everybody showed up at a meeting and they decided not to move it. So that was incredible.
Well, it's great work that you're doing there in Nelsonville, Dottie, and we appreciate you taking time to relate it to us. If you would stick with us for a few minutes, I want to go back to David here. And David, our region as a culture is historically wary of outsiders. Around here, an outsider, quote unquote, can mean somebody from the next county over. There have been lots of very well-intentioned efforts to help this very impoverished corner of our country make progress in the economy, health, education. And many people in the region do know how to work together to address community issues. They've been doing it for a long time out of necessity. So I'm wondering, how can WEAVE make an impactful and lasting difference in the region?
Yeah, I was once in Appalachian nearby you, and a guy pulled me aside and said, you know, we may hate each other, but if you outsiders criticize any of us, we'll kill you. I like the spirit of that. You know, I think we've come to see that you got to have credibility to do this work. And the people who have credibility are people who live in the towns and the neighborhoods they serve. And so a lot of people have seen outsiders come in. They have the ability to write a big foundation, get a big foundation grant. They get some money. They come in. They don't know the town. The town doesn't quite trust them. They spend the money in 3 years and then they go. People have seen that over and over again. And so we decide just to go hyper local. Do you serve your block? Do you serve the blocks around you? And if you've lived in that place for a number of years, if you've committed the way Dottie has, then you'll be trusted. And the neighborhood is the unit of change here. You can't just clean the part of the swimming pool you're swimming in. You got to clean up the whole neighborhood, and that means getting everybody involved. And so what we do is we're beginning, after we met Dottie, we're beginning to now we actually give out money. But that's not always the most important thing to do. It's telling people stories, allowing people to tell their own stories, providing them ideas and support. So we're not there to do the work. We're there, you know, each of these people who does this work or builds community, they've got a backpack that's pretty heavy. And we just say, well, what can we help you with in that backpack to make it a little lighter for you? And that's our service.
Well, you mentioned earlier, I've mentioned several times, trust. And trust is a very fragile thing. And once it's broken, it's very, very hard to put that genie back in the bottle to reestablish it. But I take it that you believe that it can be done.
Yeah, I've seen it happen. I'll just tell one story. There's a great weaving organization in Baltimore called Thread, run by a woman named Sarah Heminger. And they serve underperforming kids in the Baltimore City schools. And they basically surround them with volunteers, sort of like an extended family of volunteers. And once you're in Thread, you can never leave. So it's like family. And the volunteers will just keep showing up at your door short of a court order. And the kids have been betrayed a lot in their lives. They're distrustful for good reason. Life has not treated them well. And so when somebody shows up for them, they assume, well, this person is just going to betray me like all the others. Hmm. And so the rule of Thread is we just keep showing up. And Sarah says, it's life-changing when you've rejected somebody and they keep showing up for you. And it's life-changing to be the one rejected. And so it's that presence, the constant presence, I will be there for you, I will be there for you. It takes time to establish that trust. But I've seen it in organization after organization. It might take 3 years for somebody to settle in a neighborhood and really be trusted. But if you just keep showing up, eventually you wear down the barriers. I've seen it time and time again.
There's some very productive organizations and institutions working in this area now to improve life, the health, and economy of the area. I'm thinking of organizations like the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, the Appalachian Impact Fund, Invest 606, Apple Shop, they all come to mind. But that's on an organizational, institutional level. And am I correct that what you're talking about is truly down on the grassroots level, people to people?
Yeah, those organizations are all great and they all do wonderful work. But we focus on people who, as I say, are hyper local. They live in their neighborhood. For them, a grant of even something like $15,000, $20,000 is significant. There's a woman I met in Watts, a neighborhood in LA, named Keisha, and she just created something called Sisters of Watts. And they basically just give kids in schools backpacks filled with food and other things they can take home. And they have showers for the homeless. They do whatever needs to be done in Watts, like beautifying the neighborhood. And she just runs it out of her living room. But she's known in the community for Keisha will be there if there's a problem, and you can go to Keisha. And so that's the sort of person we've decided to focus on, not really the big foundations as much.
All right. Well, we'll all be looking forward to digging into this on February 8th when you visit Pikeville and Painesville, Kentucky, and very much looking forward to it. David Brooks, columnist for The New York Times, contributor to The Atlantic, commentator on the PBS NewsHour, NPR's All Things Considered, NBC's Meet the Press. His latest book is The Second Mountain, and you can find out what drives this by reading The Second Mountain. I recommend that. He'll be speaking in Pikeville on February 8th, and we thank you so much, David Brooks.
No, thanks so much for having us on, and so good to hear Dottie.
From Nelsonville, we've been talking with community activist Dottie Frommel, and we thank you, Dottie.
Thank you. Thank you both.
And our thanks to Bill Goodman and Kathleen Poole over at Kentucky Humanities for their help in arranging the interview with David Brooks and Dottie Frommel. On next week's edition, what clinical psychologists are seeing as the pandemic forces so many changes in our lives. We talk with practicing psychologist and EKU professor Melinda Moore.
Definitely, I've seen an increase in people reaching out, wanting to seek therapy, wanting to seek resources for mental health issues. And I'm seeing a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, but then also a lot of grief-related issues. You know, whether it's grief-related issues related to losing loved ones to COVID or grief over what the pandemic has done to our lives.
And
there's an international push to make ecocide the fifth crime that's accepted under the international court.
Veteran environmental reporter James Bruggers tapped into that movement for an in-depth report on coal's long tail.
It allowed me to look at coal through the framework of long-term damage. And while clearly coal mining and coal burning had, you know, a lot of benefits and fueled the economy for a long, long time and still fuels, 20% of our electricity in the United States, you know, we wanted to look at what are those long-term damages that coal burning and coal mining will have left behind that will have impacts for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
We'll have these stories and more on next week's edition of Eastern Standard. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. And our thanks to Madeline Peru and Larry Goldings for the use of their song, American. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org. on the WEKU mobile app, and on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.